diverse countries. 3 horrifying wars. 3 parts of the world where women carry the torch of survival. Hi, I'm Garine Cholakyan. Join me and my co-host Mona Gupta this hour as we take you around the world to learn about some of the most powerful struggles by women in 3 war-torn regions: Kashmir, Colombia, and Iraq. With voices of women from Bogota, Pakistan, and London, hear how women from across borders and oceans share their stories of despair and determination. Women and War, the story of struggle and survival. Women and War is hosted, written, and produced by Garine Cholakyan and Mona Gupta for CKLN 88.1 in proud celebration of International Women's Day. Himalayan mountains at the northernmost region of India is the state of Kashmir. From 1947 till this day, Kashmir is still referred to in international terms as a disputed territory. Professor Rita Tremblay, a Kashmir expatriate, is the chair of the political science department at Concordia University. She explains the causes of conflict in Kashmir.
Jammu and Kashmir became a problematic issue in 1947 when the British left India and divided India into India and Pakistan. They were 40% of India, which was not under British control. And these were the princely states. There were about 520 so princely states, which became almost sovereign at the time when the British left. And most of the states basically joined either India and Pakistan, and there were 3 states, princely states, which did not join either nation for various reasons. 2 of the states' problems were resolved when India took over forcibly those 2 states, but Jammu and Kashmir's king refused to join either India and Pakistan, and the reason for that being that he was Hindu ruler of a majority Muslim princely state, and moreover, he was facing a nationalist movement which was very pro-Indian National Congress. So his options were very limited. Had he joined Pakistan, that means he would have been deprived of any particular influence or power. Had he joined India, then the power would have moved on to the nationalist movement, which had been going on in the state of Jammu and Kashmir for about 30 or 40 years prior to 1947. And so, therefore, when he did not join either nation in 1947 after the partition, there were tribesmen who came and tried to take over the valley and Kashmir Valley, and consequently the Maharaja asked the Indian government for help. Indian government sent help by sending troops and asked the Maharaja to sign the Treaty of Accession. And in signing the Treaty of Accession, the Indian government promised that they will hold a plebiscite once law and order had been restored. The Indian army freed 2/3 of Indian Kashmir, and after that complained to the United Nations Security Council saying that Pakistan had been the aggressor and had supported the tribesmen entering into Kashmir. And the Security Council in its resolutions basically stated that once law and order had been restored in Kashmir and in both sides of the Kashmir, because the 2/3 of Kashmir stayed with India and 1/3 which the tribesmen had occupied went to Pakistan, that once forces had been withdrawn and law and order had been restored, that there will be plebiscite. Because these conditions were not accepted, Indian government refused to hold a plebiscite, and moreover, the Kashmir government created a constituent assembly and created its own constitution within Indian Kashmir and has had elections. So Indian case has been that Kashmir is an integral part of India, whereas Pakistan's case is that it's a disputed territory and they should hold a plebiscite, and these have been irreconcilable positions. So that's historically. But since 1989, there has been a secessionist movement, or what you can call a nationalist movement, depends upon which side you are on. And this movement has gone on for several years. And meanwhile, there have been three sets of elections in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, whereby about 40% of the population has participated in the electoral process. Moreover, the nationalist movement and the secessionist movement, which had been taking place in the state of Jammu and Kashmir, particularly in the valley, was initially controlled by the indigenous groups, locally based, but slowly the movement has been controlled by Pakistani-based and Afghani-based Islamic jihadi groups. And so what I would say the current situation in last 3-4 years is that there is fundamentally the movement in the hands of Hizbullah Mujahideen and the groups supported by Pakistan and Afghanistan, and consequently the intervention by the Indian state and the Indian army.
Earlier you were speaking about the nationalist movement that the Maharaja faced in 1947, but that was a pro-Indian nationalist movement.
Yes. It was a pro, one can say that it was a movement which was more secular, movement which included both Hindus and Muslims. It was against the ruler of the Kashmir, and it was for an introduction of a socialistic Kashmir. The Kashmiri nationalist movement made a very conscious effort not to align itself with the Muslim League. As a matter of fact, the Muslim League's various efforts were condemned by the Kashmiri nationalist movement. And the leader of the Kashmiri nationalist movement, Sheikh Mohammad Abdullah, was a very close friend of Jawaharlal Nehru. So the close alliance between the two groups was very, very significant. And that has had an impact in terms of what kind of nation is Kashmir and what kind of goals they want to achieve. In other words, the nationalist movement is fundamentally controlled by a group called Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front, who would like to see an independent, secular Kashmir, where there's a place for both Hindus and Muslims, whereas a very small minority group controlled by Hizbul Mujahideen and Islamic groups, they would like they would like Kashmir to be a part of Pakistan, but that's a very small minority. So the legacy, historical legacy, what you can speak about is a legacy of a secular kind of movement which existed in Kashmir, and that has had an impact in terms of what kind of nation the Kashmiri people consider themselves to be. The Jammu Kashmir Liberation Front movement or the independence movement is per se for independent Kashmir. And what they would like to do is to see the one-third of Kashmir which is under Pakistan occupation and two-thirds of Kashmir which is under Indian Indian occupation to be combined together and create an independent state, which is neither acceptable to India nor acceptable to Pakistan.
Tremblay describes how the conflict affects the lives of Kashmiri women.
Women generally, if you read about nationalist movement, are not basically the active participants in nationalist movement, but it does affect their lives. So what you see is that when there's a movement particularly accompanied by a political insurgency, is the women who are in charge of the domestic households, their lives are disrupted. So in terms of even, you know, daily going out in a shopping, trying to go and buy food, the way one runs a household is very different in a place like Kashmir as compared to, for example, the kind of life we are used to here. You go every day, you buy your vegetables, you buy your milk, you buy your meat, you make sure that kids have proper facilities for their daily operation. So from that particular point of view, what you find is there is a complete disruption of family life.
As Tremblay explains, Kashmiri women have not only played a unique but also key role in the struggle.
Women were the ones who were the secret keepers. They were the ones who had to be the quiet participants in the nationalist movement. When, for example, the security forces would come and want to search the houses, they are the ones who would basically turn the security forces away by coming out of the house, start screaming, yelling, saying, you know, our whole household is being disrupted by the security forces. Some, you know, even might scream and say that we are being raped, and the security forces are abusing us by just making tremendous amount of noise, that they would turn the security forces away from the household. And this particularly happened after the after 1990, when the Indian security forces were accused of raping women in two villages, and really being brutal so far as the search operations were conducted. So they were very extremely successful in keeping the security forces away from their particular household. So I would say the daily lives were not the same as, for example, you know, one leads in a normal household. It's a kind of a very manipulative way of participating in a nationalist movement, which takes place which took place at this particular period of time.
Are you suggesting that women have not been targeted for violence specifically, but that they have tended to exaggerate claims?
No, I'm not at all suggesting that. I think in the initial stages, women were targeted. In the initial stages, you had certain villages, for example, like Sopor, where the border security forces and other paramilitary forces did go in and did rape women and did very forcefully entered into various households and treated women very, very badly. But consequently, what we also saw, that human rights groups such as Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Asia Watch, did publicize these things. And out of shame, the Indian government did appoint human rights commissions, Indian Human Rights Commission and State Human Rights Commission, which looked into these particular abuses. And in order to rectify the situation and in order to also for the Indian state to legitimize its own intervention, it had to control its own forces. So at that time, the women found that this method of keeping the security forces was very useful in terms of not letting them come into their household and protecting their children.
By bonding together, Kashmiri women have proven to be a strong force in the Kashmiri conflict.
At a deeper level, women become collaborators in a movement in a very kind of covert way. I visited several refugee camps in 1994, 95, 96. Most of the refugee camps are in. So women become the heads of the household under those particular situations, because men go out. The men who want to make earning, they go out of the refugee camps or travel to other cities to make money for the family, and so women are the ones who are in charge of educating their children, taking care of the older family members, and the life is extremely, extremely difficult for them, and have mostly been the ones who have been confined to the private realm. And in this private realm, because they have been confined, so they use the private realm in order to send the messages out. So, for example, women, when Hizbul Mujahideen in 1989 and 1990 wanted to send messages that Kashmir should be turned into an Orthodox Islamic society, and asked that all Kashmiri Muslim women should wear a veil, and Hindu women should go and put dots on their foreheads so that they can be identified as Hindus, is the Muslim women who actually ensured that such a kind of decree is not properly implemented. So how did they do that? They did not get out of their houses for 2 weeks. They just made sure that they wouldn't go out, because Kashmiri Muslim women do not most majority of women do not veil themselves. So in order to defeat that particular ordinance, they just didn't go out. And after 2 or 3 weeks, they went out the same way they have always gone out. And this is a private battle which is won in a very different way, in a very private, with using the techniques developed in the private realm, which are opened up in the public arena. And so women have participated, but in a very different way. It's a joint family system. It's through gossips, through talk. Women talk to each other, controlling information. And I think those are the basic techniques by which, quiet resistance takes place. So it's things whereby women control their domestic arena and their private arena, and this happens through the private network of families. And so, people will talk to each other, through visiting each other or on telephone, and will suggest basically that, look, this is not acceptable, and let's not go out for 2 or 3.
Still, the violence against women in Kashmir continues to be severe.
Hello? Hello?
Over muffled phone lines from Pakistan, Shamima Shaw, activist and founder of the Kashmir Women's Forum, is trying to be heard.
Hello?
Hello, can you hear me?
Hello?
But she is trying to communicate far across a bad phone connection.
Hello?
She is trying to make the plight of women in Kashmir heard.
There are so many young girls who have been raped. They are waiting for justice. But in this situation, where there are more than 700,000 army forces in Kashmir, it is not possible to get justice. But we are trying to convince the people. We are trying to educate the Indian people, especially the women of Indian society, to come to help the Kashmiri women who are waiting for justice and for peace.
According to Shaw, women have paid the greatest price in the Kashmiri conflict.
The most affected population of India, Kashmir, is Kashmiri women. Although they are not getting justice from the government of India, it was in 1990 early, when it was a peaceful demonstration going on in Kashmir. The Indian forces immediately pressurized the Kashmiri public and Kashmiri people by oppressing and depressing the women folk, by killing and by raping them. As it the main episode was of the Kudan Poshpura in 1991 February, and then it was going on in different parts of the Kashmir, like in Chandpora, Srinagar, in Sopor, in Baramulla. It was repeated by the Indian forces to rape and gang rape the women. This was the most bad situation in this dispute, that the women was made forcibly affected by the Indian forces.
While the conflict may be based on religious differences, all Kashmir women, whether they be Muslim or Hindu, are being targeted, explains Shaw.
There is no difference of Hindu and Muslim, because the Kashmiri population is a mixture of Hindu, Muslim, Sikh, Buddhist, and different minorities are there. People belong to different religions are there. But we cannot say that it is the only Muslim population. It is the Hindu population too, it is the Sikh population too, it is the minority population too who have been affected by the Indian forces.
Shaw's proposal for a solution to end the conflict.
We understand it as Kashmiri that it is the Pakistan and India, that they both should sit on the table to solve the Kashmir problem, because it is not only the problem of the both two countries, but it is the problem of the South Asia. This conflict should be resolved by a peaceful dialogue between the two countries, India and Pakistan. we must, as women, we must encourage the dialogue, because we are the peace-loving people, especially the Kashmiri people. They do not want war in this region. They want to solve the problem. Therefore, we also try to promote the dialogue and some other peaceful arrangements between the two countries.
Vijay Munshi is also a Kashmiri expatriate who now lives in Nova Scotia. She voluntarily left Kashmir 26 years ago, but knows the area well. Every 2 years since her departure, she has returned to Kashmir with her two daughters to visit family and friends. But in 1990, all that changed.
After 1990, my family moved to other parts of India because of conflict in the Kashmir, and there was an unrest, and almost all Hindu families start leaving Kashmir because they had to leave because they didn't feel safe because of the unrest.
What was going on there? Can you tell us a bit about that?
Well, there was there was trouble. Like, I can't really comment on that myself, but it's just my observation that there was all sorts of terrorism going on in Kashmir, and Hindu people didn't feel safe. And it was not only Hindu people were leaving, there were some Muslim families also leaving.
Even within the safe haven of North American borders, Vijay seems to fear for family members who may still be in Kashmir.
It has been my observation that Kashmiri women have freedom of speech and engage in all kinds of professions. Basically, people from Kashmir are peace-loving and don't want any conflict.
Do you think that the conflict has affected Hindu women differently from Muslim women?
Oh, it hasn't affected or changed Hindu women at all. They continue to exercise freedom of speech and other democratic rights. I'm not aware of any drastic changes in Kashmiri Hindu women's lives. I cannot tell you if Kashmiri women are treated differently now than they were treated before.
And what about Muslim women?
Well, it is same thing. I can't comment on Muslim women, but they were same like Hindu women. So I can't comment on that subject.
The Republic of Colombia, a country of 42 million people, the third most populous in Latin America, is rich in geographical diversity, with its mountains and beaches, savannas and jungles. It is also endowed with natural resources such as fossil fuels, precious metals and gems, and significant manufacturing and agricultural sectors. The ethnic plurality of Colombia's people reflect its strength. There are descendants of Spaniards, Africans, indigenous peoples, and of course people whose ethnicity is mixed, an emblem of new identities. Colombia is also, sadly, one of the most dangerous countries in the world. The Colombian people are witness to and victims of the most massacres and kidnappings on earth. Margarita Martinez, an Associated Press journalist living in Colombia's capital, Bogota, explained the origins of Colombia's long war this way.
Well, Colombia officially has been in an internal conflict, as we call it here, for 38 years, and that's the date where the FARC, the biggest rebel group, was officially founded. But violence in Colombia comes way, way back. There's a period that is called the violence in the 40s and 50s. It was a war between the two parties at the time, the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party. That was solved, or partially solved, but the violence never stopped. There was a period of more, a comma period, if we can call it that way, in the 80s. And then in the 90s, there was, you know, the drug wars. And now, at the end of the 90s, is when the civil conflict, let's say the arisal or the strengthening of the FARC, and the formation of the paramilitary groups began, and with them, the escalation of the war that is now taking a huge toll on Colombian people, not only on soldiers and guerrillas, but on civil people especially. There's some statistics that say that one out of every nine people who die are the people who are actually fighting. 8 out of 9 are actually civilians who are dying in this civil conflict.
The drug trade is often blamed for the violence in Colombia. Martinez explains its role.
Well, in the 90s, the government had a war against the drug cartels. As some of you might remember, Pablo Escobar was a leader of the Medellin cartel, and he fought the state with all his money and his power to prevent extradition to the U.S. that at the time was his biggest concern. He said he preferred to die in Colombia than to be in prison in the States. So he put bombs, killed judges, policemen, soldiers, presidential candidates, journalists, to prevent the government to extradite him. Finally, in 1993, he was killed by the government forces, and with his death, all the other people, all the Medellin cartel members, went to jail, and that was basically pacified, Medellin and the whole country. Then the government started the war, let's say, against the Cali cartel, and that was a little bit easier in the sense that they didn't put bombs. But still, all that money, the drug money that the cartels used to handle, went to the guerrillas. The guerrillas start getting into the business. They start not only taxing the cocoa fields, but much more. And that's when analysts here think that the conflict really started escalating, because they have a huge source of financing that was the drug money. So now, year 2002, paramilitaries and guerrillas are financed by this money that was left out of the drug money that was left out of the from the cartels that, you know, mostly disappeared, and, you know, just, you know, few organizations here or there, but never as powerful as what Colombia lived through the Medellin cartel and the Cali cartel.
Between the government military and rebel forces is yet another source of violence and fear, the paramilitaries, sometimes referred to as death squads.
The paramilitaries are a group that was formed by several people who cattle ranchers who the guerrilla extorted and kidnapped and killed. Drug money, drug lords who had increasingly bought lands in rural areas, and the guerrillas went and tried to extort and kidnap. And just regular people, you know, at the beginning it was pretty much based on cattle ranchers and drug lords. But as the guerrillas started, you know, extorting more people, kidnapping, killing more middle-class people joined into their, you know, into those groups that they say that originally were found because the state couldn't protect them. But as you know, they are the authors of most of the massacres that occurred between 1999 and 2001. Apparently, they have said that they're not going to massacre anymore, but their resurgence and how they started controlling areas was very traumatic for a lot of rural areas where they just got in and started killing everybody they thought was with the guerrillas.
Sheila Gruner, an organizer of the Canada-Colombia Solidarity Campaign, CCSC for short, told us about how the plight of rural peasants has contributed to the ongoing armed struggle in Colombia.
The key instigator of the conflict, a lack of sufficient agrarian reform in the 60s led to campesinos taking arms, that led to the creation of the FARC, which still exists today. It's the longest guerrilla movement in all of South America, who's still in arms. In Colombia, it's a situation where you've got large landowners that have maintained large lots of land and have been clearing lands as well for of smaller peasants. And there's been a number of policies and development policies trying to get small campesinos off land. So what we have are the smaller peasants trying to establish their rights to remain on their lands, and no reform has been adequate into allowing them to do so. So because of the lack of adequate response by the government in terms of agrarian reform, the FARC took up arms. That doesn't mean that all of the small peasants are with the FARC necessarily. It's become very different today what it was in the 60s, for example.
Margarita Martinez says that women have become actively involved in the armed struggle.
Well, they say the guerrillas have one of every three fighters are women, and they said they're wonderful fighters. At the beginning, they started, you know, accepting women only because they wanted it, you know, cooks or just, you know, nurses or people who would take care of more, like, let's say, female kind of things. But then all of a sudden they start incorporating as fighters, and the FARC says that they're wonderful fighters, and so the soldiers in Paris who fight against them. The reason, I don't know the reason, I've been asking around, and they say that maybe said women proved themselves, that some women got the chance to or wanted to be fighters, and that they the guerrillas accepted it, and then from then on they never went back. No one really knows what were the reasons, because the FARC is a peasant organization, and as they call here, very machista. But women, some say that women just start asking for a place in the combat, you know, with the troops. And that's how they started. And now in every front, in every military unit, the FARC has their women, not only as nurses, not only as cooks, but just as regular fighters. Though there are no women who are commanders. I understand there's apparently one in Central Colombia, but I've never met her and don't know of her. But in the negotiating table or in the high ranks of the FARC, at least the ones who they promote, there are no women. There are no women who are visible. The Army of Colombia doesn't have women in the ranks as fighters. They have it as administrative personnel, or journalists, or nurses, or other positions, but not as fighters. The paramilitaries are now recruiting women. They say that that they got an example from the guerrillas, and they say that 1 out of 10. Of the fighters is a woman. That's basically from the last 2 years. Before they didn't used to have any woman in their ranks.
It's quite unusual for women to be involved in an armed struggle to the extent that they seem to be in Colombia. What cultural or social factors do you think accounts for this?
Colombia is some differences from the rest of Latin America. Women in Colombia are the women who work the most out of their houses, according to World Bank statistics. And, there are two women presidential candidates at the moment for the next elections in May, and they have an informed representation in the Senate and in the, basically in all the government positions. But I don't know if that would account that they're also fighters, but I think there's a cultural trend for women to be in every place of society. Feminists would say that it's not enough, and certainly that's true. But in comparison to the rest of Latin America, and even, by European or American standards, women here are in every kind of position. I think maybe because of they're in the banking industry, in politics, in social organizations, they're also in the war.
But women are involved in violent conflict in many ways, not just as fighters.
That's really one of the main focuses of our work, building reciprocal solidarity with the popular movements. That's specifically the unarmed popular movements, the movements that have been silenced by war. They're silent because they don't have weapons, they don't have money to get out of the country either. All of those things. It's really important to focus on unarmed and peace movements during a time of war, which has been a long time in Colombia, but more now than ever. And it's a strong and growing movement, despite the fragmentations and the constant obstacles that are faced throughout the country. And of course, it's not one. There's many processes in Colombia, peace processes from diverse cultural backgrounds. There's a number of national processes for peace as well that really have diverse analyses about the determinants of the conflict. But there's a growing one that's particularly important, the popular unarmed peace processes that are coming out of the base movements, the grassroots organizations, such as the Organización Femenino Popular, the Women's Popular Organization, who have a campaign now, against fear, the imposition of fear, which has been really what they consider one of the strongest tools of the establishment against the popular communities is instilling fear so that they can't organize their community events and their community kitchens and whatnot, all of their efforts. This campaign, it's one of the most important ones that is being developed in Barranca Bermeja in Colombia. Yolanda Bercera, who's the leader of the Women's Popular Organization, she made statements about that campaign against fear, that they, something to the effect of, we won't stop being because of fear. Really,
it's better to be with fear than to stop being because of fear.
That's right. Yeah, thanks, Felina. Yeah. And so to get back to the issue of the peace movement, it's, as I said, it's diverse, but it's also, it's got many levels. You know, there's the NGO peace movement and the government side of the peace and their peace process. They're trying to, you know, there is a peace process between the state and the, or there was a peace process between the state and the FARC, the longest standing guerrilla movement there, which has been broken. So, it's a hard thing to really articulate, you know, what is the peace process in Colombia, because there's been such a manipulation of the word peace at the same time. But what we consider is the most important one, the most important thing to be focusing on, are the popular movements, the unarmed popular movements that are facing the aggressions directly. They're the ones that are caught between the fire of the two, or the many armed actors that are in the country. We need to focus on what they are saying and where they think the country should go. They are the majority of Colombians, and again, they're the ones that are facing directly the aggressions of globalization and the conflict.
Paulina Vivanco, another organizer of the CCSC, explains that women's involvement in peace building has occurred at many levels.
There, you know, and I don't know if this is particular to women, but people find themselves forced in a war that they claim is not theirs, either through their children joining a guerrilla or the paramilitaries, or even just an urban gang. A city, for example, like Medellin is totally taken over by urban gangs in the popular neighborhoods. If you're a 15-year-old boy, you have to decide what side you're on, and it's not really an option to not become another statistic, for lack of opportunity, for, you know, the gangs in the neighborhoods are doing very much what the guerrillas and the paramilitaries are doing out in the countryside. It's just fighting for territory. And so, you know, that's one of the factors, I guess, that's driven women to become involved in the peace movement, in addition to the particular violence faced by them as women. Like in any war, women's bodies are used as territory for war, either through rape, aggressions in general.
And I'd say, too, just to add on to that, if I could, you know, women are the ones who actually face all the major aggressions in the war. They're the ones who lose their husbands and fathers and sons who go to war. I mean, yes, there are women as well in the armed groups, but definitely not as much as men. And it's considered very much by the women's groups that we've been in touch with, a man's war. And it's the woman who lives at home and deals with the children left without a father. They experience the forced displacement in particular ways. They become the heads of the household. They're the ones who are on the ground constantly, day by day, feeling and facing the most daily and horrific effects of the war. So from there, they become involved. From that very daily experience of war, they become involved, up to very political and involved women in the peace process. They've been pushing for a voice, a woman's voice in the peace process, what there was of it. People like from the Casa de la Mujer, from the Gruta Pacifica, from many different women's movements. There's many throughout Colombia. They actually had a meeting in Europe late last year, to talk about having a women's position within the peace process, having a voice of women, because they are the ones who most directly face the impacts of this war.
And how successful have they been in making progress towards having a direct voice at the table?
It's been really difficult. Really, it's been limited, quite limited, to the FARC and the government.
And so the, you know, they have, where they have been incredibly successful is mobilizing people around the country and around the world in recognizing that, you know, peace without women's voices, without the voices of many Afro-descendants and indigenous and campesinos and people from the labor movement is not a real peace. It's a peace between two warring actors, and that's not really going to necessarily be representative of what the country is about. So they've mobilized people not just on their own, on the behalf of the women's movement, but on behalf of the women's movement and the many other diverse struggles that are going on in the country.
Margarita Martinez.
Women organizations have been asked, the government and even the rebel organizations, to give them space. But so far, in the negotiating table that, as you know, was and the peace process ended on February 20th, there was no women on that negotiating table. There were 5 men from the FARC, 5 men from the government, no women. So the women, you know, have been very much involved in, you know, the mothers, daughters, and wives of the police and soldiers who are kidnapped by the FARC go there and ask for their release, ask for more human conditions. Some of them have been in prison for almost 5 years. I mean, in FARC prisons. Also, you know, women organizations have said that, you know, the conflict has to be more humane, but so far they haven't got a space in any of the formal negotiating tables, and that's something they would like to, you know, to get change.
Sheila Gruner.
Perhaps we can end with a quote from Yolanda Becerra from the OFP in her campaign against fear. She says, "Fear is a strategy of the totalizing power. That is why the continuity of the courage of resistance, the commitment for life and against war, and the campaign against fear threaten the totalitarian project. That is why we are being persecuted. Because we confront fear, we are an enemy that can break the totalitarian structure. The campaign against fear is a political position. The struggle against fear is an ideological struggle, profoundly ideological. To break fear is to break the totalitarian power structure, resist, and propose alternatives from the perspective of women." That's Yolanda Becerra from the OFP, August 17th, 2001, in Barranca Bermeja, during the International Women's March Against War.
Horror. It is the only word to describe what the people of Iraq have relentlessly experienced for the past 2 decades. Just 2 years after an 8-year U.S.-backed war with Iran, Iraq was about to experience one of the darkest chapters in the history of mankind. In 1991, with the help of the biggest ever American-led international alliance, millions of tons of toxic uranium ammunition explosives were dumped on Iraq during the Gulf War. Following the war, a brutal economic embargo, vetoing everything from hospital medicines to paper, was imposed on Iraq by the U.S. government to punish the Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein for invading Kuwait. The objective was to coerce the Iraqi leadership to rid itself of weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, by the end of the Gulf War, more than 14,000 high-caliber shells were fired on Iraq, to the extent, it is reported, of bringing the country down to the pre-industrial age.
You know, the pounding that Iraq got, there was a feeling of huge, huge injustice.
Speaking from the United Kingdom, Felicity Arbuthnot is an award-winning print and broadcast journalist with an expert knowledge of the Middle East.
And the way that they hung on, I mean, the water went off within the first hour, the electricity went off within the first hour. So they had 42 days pounding without even being able to provide, you know, water except from standpipes in the street. And, of course, it was already polluted because all the pipes had been ruined. They felt the overkill was incredibly unjust.
Having visited Iraq 24 times since the Gulf War, Arbuthnot has seen the social impact of the war on the lives of Iraqi women.
As the embargo started to bite, unemployment rose so sharply, and it's now nearly 80%. women were forced back into the homes. So in fact, in Iraq, it wasn't the Taliban type system that forced them back. It was the United Nations sanctions. And so you now get actually a very depressed, educated level of women, because all their education is just lost. The husbands go out and look for work. The women can no longer afford to pay somebody to look after their children. If they have parents or an extended family, usually they don't live around the corner, and the transport systems collapse, so they can't come in and fill in. So the women are really back in the kitchen.
Experts now say the Gulf War was the most toxic war in the history of mankind, specifically because of the use of uranium ammunition. Symptoms, which collectively came to be known as the Gulf War Syndrome, include damages to organs, chronic fatigue, memory loss, swollen glands, dental bleeding, and most notably, malformation of newborns. Studies have shown that depleted uranium, a highly toxic metal, is responsible for congenital deformities in Iraqi and American children. When in Iraq, Arbuthnot spends a great deal of time in hospitals where she is an eyewitness to the result of both U.S. sanctions and the horrifying effects of American uranium ammunition explosives on the lives of Iraqi civilians.
I think the whole nation is, especially the women who, one's primeval instinct, isn't it, is to look after your family and your children. And the whole nation is totally disempowered. I mean, this idea that Saddam is going to be overthrown, the more we put the squeeze on them, the more we disallow clean water, education, health, basic standard that one takes for granted, just to minimally sustain life, you withdraw it all. And all they're thinking of is, can they feed their child that day? Can they get medicine for their child that day? Will their husband get a day's work that day? I mean, the idea that Iraq is going to rise up and overthrow Saddam, as I say, is just an absolute nonsense. And even, as you say, totally, totally disempowered. And even sort of things that should be a joy, like childbirth. I mean, in Basra, for instance, which is, beautiful, battered second city, which was, of course, in the eye of Desert Storm, where you have this appalling, appalling legacy of cancers and also birth defects. And, in Basra, you can find the unimaginable. You can find babies with no arms, no legs, no heads, internal organs on the outside. I mean, just... It's, and I watched them born. I mean, this isn't an Iraqi propaganda thing. And when a woman, for instance, that joy of having a baby says, how is it, doctor, when it's born? There is this terror in her voice and eyes, because they all know. I mean, this is not a secret. It's, it's in the public psyche. So everything normal has just been withdrawn.
Having worked as a senior researcher with former Assistant UN Secretary General Dennis Halliday, Arbuthnot reports on the environmental impact of depleted uranium in Iraq.
Depleted uranium was used in an enormous quantity for the first time in the 1991 Gulf War. And what had happened, unknown largely to the public and in fact to the military, the Western military, the nuclear industry, in a sort of Machiavellian move, had it's waste from the nuclear industry, from the fuel cycle, right? And the nuclear industry, not knowing how to get rid of it, it's very expensive to store or dispose of, and of course nobody wants it in a repository in their sort of a geographical backyard. So the nuclear industry gave it free to the weapons industry on the basis that it's harder than titanium, which was used as a coating and for missiles and bullets. Burns at a higher temperature, more bangs for your bucks. But it remains chemically toxic and radioactive for 4.5 billion years. Depleted uranium will still be poisoning the earth when the sun goes out. And in Basra, which was so bombed so devastatingly. It's in the fauna, the flora, the water. And this is what has been linked to this huge rise in birth deformities and cancers. But whatever, you know, something absolutely horrendous has happened in Iraq.
For both Iraqi women, as well as Iraqi society as a whole, political empowerment is a luxury few can afford.
This was a country which, prior to the embargo, for instance, there was 93%, these are WHO figures, World Health Organization figures, 93% access to free, high-quality health care, about the same to clean water, and the same from nursery education right through free university education at a very high level. They have now been reduced to, for instance, in Basra, which has been linked to the depleted uranium weapons which we use. The cancers have gone up up to 70%. That's the highest rising cancers in the world. Women are forced to just stand over their children in hospitals and watch them die because there is simply virtually no treatment. I mean, for years and years and years, the treatments for cancers were vetoed. Even in nebulizers for asthma was vetoed. I mean, everything you can think of was vetoed. Children now, they were so proud of the education. I mean, if you called at anybody's house, even early days of the sanctions, the first thing they'd say after saying how lovely to see you, and this is at every educational level, is, you know, do you know whatever the name of the child was came second, third, fourth in his class today or yesterday or last week. You know, education was such a big deal, and now for the most part children are just sent out on the street to beg. One of the interesting things I did about 4 years ago, I did a series for a magazine, and they said ask young women what their aspirations are. You know, ones that were sort of 10 at the time of the embargo, and we were now sort of 8 or 9 years on, so they were 18, 19, 20 or whatever. And I asked them their sort of hopes, dreams and fears, and one just looked at me and said, I'm too tired to dream. Another one, her dream was just to have enough milk for her baby. And another one just looked at me from a very educated family, beautifully dressed, because they always say that our pride is all we have left. And I'd never sort of seen this side of her. And she waited till her mother had left the room, and then she just looked at me and she said, Felicity, there's nothing for us. We don't have any hopes or dreams or fears. She said, only death awaits us. 19 years old.
Wishtan Al-Sukhni, a 22-year-old medical student at the University of Toronto, lived in Iraq during the Gulf War. She experienced firsthand the impact of war and sanctions on women and remembers the terror of war.
Essentially, the Iraqi army basically walked right into Kuwait and took over. And that was something that my family and I were among all the people who experienced, because we were living in Kuwait at the time. And so it was, in a way, almost like overnight Kuwait became a part of Iraq, and that's the way Iraq sort of even stated it. It became like they had just joined the rest of Iraq, and it was actually quite frightening, because everybody who knew what Iraq was like on the inside, and many people who had basically left it to escape all the tyranny and the problems inside, realized all of a sudden that that was going to all suddenly come over to Kuwait.
Wishtan insists the horror experienced by the Iraqi people extends beyond the effects of U.S. sanctions to human rights violations by the regime.
The human rights situation in Iraq is really terrible. I mean, that word in itself isn't enough to describe it. The human rights situation actually today it might very well be the most terrible yet, because now you've got the impact of the government's policies towards its own people, compounded by the effect of the sanctions that have been in place for over 11 years. So in terms of the impact, in terms of the government's own role in the human rights abuses, that's something that could take up volumes of books to explain. And the very basics of it is that ever since the current government, the current government that is in Iraq right now. Ever since that came to power, human rights abuses had been just escalating towards the Iraqis. There was a great repression. There's so many stories that one actually hears about the kind of torture that people are subjected to, the kind of separation that families are subjected to. So many people. I explained to you that many women lost their husbands through the war, but I think that there was a tremendous number of families that actually lost their fathers or uncles or sons or whatever the case may be, not really necessarily through the war, but because they were taken away and had disappeared, essentially, for whatever reason, but it was from the government's action. This is actually the human rights impact on the Iraqi people has been really, really tremendous, because it's not only affected people individually, it has essentially affected the entire Iraqi society. I talked a bit about the fear and terror that people had, and that it got transferred to their children and to the next generations. Well, in a great amount of that was really the fear of what was going on the inside, not really so much just the war, because everyone, I would say, had been somehow impacted by losing somebody because they'd been taken away and imprisoned or killed. Everybody, almost everyone, has some sort of story like that. If you get any group of Iraqi people together, they'll have these kind of stories. It's a recurrent theme. You know, you've got those people who are part of the party who have got some sort of power. They can essentially do whatever they wish. And the rest of the population has basically been terrorized, cowered, so that they will not even say anything to criticize. Part of it is, for example, in terms of opportunities for work and education. You know, people who do not show their support for the regime, who do not even perhaps be actually part of the party, etc., they would not have opportunities to advance. And these are kind of things that perhaps would be seen in many kinds of regimes that are repressive. But there is the additional aspect that it's not enough to simply not criticize. Even if you try to stay quiet, even if you try to just sort of mind your own business, you're not really left alone. There is a sense of trying to get into people's minds, trying to almost, it's almost like if you think like the Inquisitions, you know, back, I guess, hundreds of years ago, when they were trying to determine who you know, thinks in the way that they don't agree with. It's not just enough to stop you and target you if you actually do something that they don't agree with. It's also the fact of they don't want anyone to even think or contemplate opposition. And so there are numerous spies throughout. You know, people within families have been recruited to be spies on their family members. And I state this because from my perspective, I really think that this kind of practice has really, really destroyed, I'm hoping there is hope to rebuild this kind of society, but I really think that it has had a very negative impact on the Iraqi society, the structure of the society. People are very mistrustful of each other. There's no longer a sense of that one wants to do good for others, because people have been so abused that there is a sense that each for his own, if that's the right way to say it, that everyone is going to do whatever it takes to just try to survive and possibly get ahead if they can. But that has really negatively impacted the society. This is something that I am saying based on comments from people who have actually experienced what life was like before. And very definitely it seems that there was a tremendous transformation in the structure of the society. So these are some examples I mentioned.
Still, like Arbuthnot, Wishtan attests to the effects of U.S. economic sanctions.
There's the additional aspect that you've got the sanctions. The sanctions have really violated the human rights of the Iraqi people even further, because basically people can't get food, they can't get medication, they can't even, that's of course the basics of living, and then there's also the aspects of education. I mean, there's even pencils have been reported to be on the list of banned substances from going into Iraq. Certainly the educational level in Iraq has basically stopped at what it was like 11 years ago and quite possibly regressed. You know, the economic situation is absolutely terrible. Those who are poor, those who do not have money to make it, are going further and further down into poverty. And I mean, you know, I've read it and heard it said that it's become such that there is no longer a middle class in Iraq.
And like Arbuthnot, Wishtan says there is very little hope for the people of Iraq.
I mean, I don't want to be pessimistic about it, but there's a lot of people who look at the situation and think to themselves, you know, this society is never going to recover because the impact has been so deep. It's gone inside everybody's heart. It, you know, even affects communities, Iraqi communities outside of Iraq. So I definitely, it's not going to be easy. But certainly, it's the first thing that needs to happen is changes within the country. There needs to be some source of hope, which doesn't exist at this moment. At this moment, everything seems bleak. There's, you know, everything that is talked about with respect to Iraq seems to pose more danger, not hope, for the Iraqi people. So certainly, I think that society, I believe, you know, as I said, I don't want to be pessimistic. So I think that there is hope that if there are some changes made, if people are given a chance to breathe again, so to speak, if people are again given a chance to experience life, you know, in a peaceful way without having the terror constantly there, then hopefully over time, perhaps the people of this generation who are living there don't have as much hope for recovery. But I'm hoping, I'm really sincerely hoping that the children of the next generation, and of course this is again to tie it back to women. I mean, we all know that children, especially in those kind of situations when many of the fathers are not there or whatever the situation may be, they're very much affected by their mothers and by the messages they receive from their mothers. So I'm hoping that that kind of hope can be instilled by women. And in order for it to be instilled into the children by their mothers, those women need to experience hope. And so, you know, there's no easy answer to your question. And it's not something that I can specifically pinpoint, but it's more a matter of having to change the situation and then hope that it'll get better eventually.
In 1868, the American suffragette Elizabeth Cady Stanton addressed the Women's Suffragette Convention in Washington, D.C. In that speech, she reflected on the perspectives that women had to offer and how women's participation in the political process could improve American society. Almost 150 years later, her words still reflect the pressing need to recognize women's experiences beyond the ballot box and into their daily struggle with war, conflict, and violence.
The strong natural characteristics of womanhood are repressed and ignored in dependence. For so long as man feeds woman, she will try to please the giver and adapt herself to his condition. To keep a foothold in society, woman must be as near like man as possible, reflect his ideas, opinions, virtues, motives, prejudices, and vices. She must respect his statutes, though they strip her of every inalienable right and conflict with that higher law written by the finger of God on her soul. She must look at everything from its dollar and cent point of view, or she is a mere romancer. She must accept things as they are and make the best of them. To mourn over the miseries of others, the poverty of the poor, their hardships in jails, prisons, asylums, the horrors of war, cruelty and brutality in every form, all this would be mere sentimentalizing. To protest against the intrigue, bribery, and corruption of public life, to desire that her sons might follow some business that did not involve lying, cheating, and a hard, grinding selfishness would be arrant nonsense. In this way, man has been molding woman to his ideas by direct and positive influences, while she, if not a negation, has used indirect means to control him, and in most cases developed the very characteristics both in him and herself that needed repression. And now man himself stands appalled at the results of his own excesses, and mourns in bitterness that falsehood, selfishness, and violence are the law of life.
We would like to thank all the women who shared their stories. Wishtan Al-Sukhni, Felicity Arbuthnot, Sheila Grunner, Margarita Martinez, Vijay Munshi, Shamina Shaw, Rita Tremblay, and Paulina Vivanco, and the CKLN News Department for its support. Women and War was hosted, written, and produced by Garina Cholakian and Mona Gupta for CKLN 88.1 in proud celebration of International Women's Day.